This episode of The Telegram is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. And as a Telegram podcast listener, you will receive 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code Telegraph. Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. This week, our foreign correspondent tells us what he can see in Kiev. Protesters murdered, makeshift hospitals, and the spirit of revolution. All of which prompts us to ask, what can the West do? Also, can a Christian vote conservative in good conscience? We dissect the growing rift between church and state. A truce has been offered in Ukraine, but that hasn't stopped the bloodshed. The fierce battle over whether Ukrainians faced east or west has left scores dead and hundreds wounded, and now the country seems to be on the brink of civil war. Earlier today, I spoke with The Telegraph's chief foreign correspondent, David Blair, who is in Kiev. I began by asking him what he had seen.
This morning, there was a lot of shooting down at Independence Square, which everyone calls the Maidan, where all the protests are taking place. And 10 bodies were laid out beneath the awning of a cafe. Two of them arrived when I was there. Neither of those bodies had been covered. They were being brought on green military stretchers. And both of them were young men, and they had both been shot through the head, killed, so far as I could see, by a single round.
So you think this is the work of snipers rather than ordinary police?
Well, what I can say for certain is that these men were killed with single shots to the head. I spoke to one of the people who brought the bodies, and he described where this particular person had been killed, and it was right up at the front line where the protesters are confronting the riot police. Now, all I can say, based upon everything I've seen and everything I know, is that these people were killed by professionals, and that whoever was firing those shots clearly intended to kill them. There's no question of warning shots or anything like that. So I think on balance of probability, they were almost certainly the work of a sniper. Given that all the dead were protesters, it would suggest that the sniper was working for the government side. And I can really see no other credible explanation. If someone could put it to me, I'll be delighted to listen to it, but I can't think of any other at the moment.
We're getting reports of makeshift hospitals being set up in hotel lobbies. Have you seen anything like that?
I understand that, first of all, makeshift hospitals are set up all over the place in Kiev. There's a beautiful cathedral that's 1,000 years old with a golden dome that's now overrun with wounded people and piled high with medicine and volunteers who are treating them. I haven't seen one in a hotel lobby, but it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. There's a great volume now of wounded people, and I would be very surprised if the 10 corpses that I saw are the only corpses from this morning. I think it's very clear that other people have been killed too. I've seen reports of up to 35 dead so far today, which, if that were true, that would make this by far the bloodiest day since this whole episode began.
So you certainly don't accept the government's official statistics. I mean, earlier they were saying around 28 people killed. Do you think it's going to be much, much higher than that?
Well, I don't know. I can personally confirm 10, and I've heard a great deal of shooting, and there's a lot of violence taking place across the city. So I would be pretty sure that it was higher than 10, but how much higher, I don't know.
Okay. Why do you think the speaking about a truce has not reduced tensions?
Truces never really do reduce tensions. Truces come and truces go. And sometimes the most dangerous time to be in central Kiev is during a truce. So I don't think anyone really took that seriously. My reading of the situation is that President Yanukovych has a tactic of keeping his enemies constantly off balance. So one moment he declares a truce and offers to negotiate. The next moment, 10 dead bodies lie in the street having been shot by a sniper. An assault takes place one night. The next night, it's calm. These mixed messages, this constant changing of posture, I think is part of his tactic.
Is there one thing he could do, I'm thinking of his resignation, that might bring it to an end?
Well, the situation is, he's made every other concession that's possible. He's sacked his entire government, including his prime minister. He got rid of 9 very obnoxious security laws, which the protesters wanted him to scrap. So he's done everything except depart. So that's why this crisis is now reaching its peak, because two things are absolutely clear. One is the protesters aren't going to go home unless the president resigns. And the second is that the security forces are prepared to kill people in order to keep the president in his place. So you have a clash between an irresistible force and an immovable object. But at the moment, we can't tell how this is going to play out.
Do you see the possibility of full civil conflict and possibly even civil war?
People do talk about that. I'm struck by how Ukrainians themselves will bring up that possibility without any prompting, entirely spontaneously, and talk about it with great seriousness. Now, I can't judge whether that's a realistic possibility or not, but I can tell you that in the center of Kiev this morning, as the gunfire rang out and as the bodies were brought in, it did feel like a capital which was in the early stages of a civil war.
David Blair, thank you very much. That was David Blair from Kiev. I'm now joined by Janet Daly and Peter Oborn, and we're going to try and put the crisis in Ukraine into a broader perspective. This week, we've read about a number of regimes turning on their own people. A UN report compared North Korea to Nazi Germany. The opposition leader was arrested amid demonstrations in Venezuela. There is a sense of tragic failure in relation to the bloodbath and use of chemical weapons in Syria. And now we have the nightmarish scenes from Kiev. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Arab Spring, it felt like the world was moving towards liberal democracy. Well, perhaps we were wrong. Janet Daly, what's the cause of the problem?
Well, the only people who seem to have benefited from the end of the Cold War, bizarrely, are the Russians, because Putin has been allowed to step into the vacuum left by the West, whose nerve seems to have completely collapsed in the face of genocide, the use of chemical weapons, the enslavement of people by their own regimes, the assassination of dissidents. Because we got so enamored of the idea that this was a peaceful world now after the Cold War, we seem to have lost any capacity for a sense of moral outrage that leads to useful constructive intervention. Now, in the wake of what is seen as a calamitous interventions by George Bush, the White House, the Obama White House, has decided that it is completely non-interventionist. It's renounced the idea of American exceptionalism. Europe, as we have seen repeatedly, is useless, even in its own backyard. So the consequence is that we have regimes which are allowed to destroy not only the liberties but the lives of their own people with impunity.
But we have had plenty of interventions after the Cold War. West was involved in the breakup of Yugoslavia. The West was involved in the Middle East.
Europe over Yugoslavia proved to be absolutely hopeless. It wasn't until America got involved in the Serbia-Croatia conflict that anything was resolved. Now we have America saying it's up to Europe to defend itself. It's up to Europe. The Warsaw Pact is gone. The Cold War is gone. Europe, Eastern Europe, can look to its own. Obama said that specifically when he came to Eastern Europe in his first year in the presidency. We're removing the missile front because you've got to spend your own money on defense now in Europe. You can't rely on America any longer. He said that in so many words. And America has lived up, the Obama White House has lived up to that protestation. They have decided that it is not for them to intervene. And when you are the last remaining superpower in the world, whatever you think of American supposed sort of imperialistic tendencies, which are wildly overdone by the left, somebody has got to take responsibility. Otherwise, okay, we're just saying that a government, democratic or not, can do anything it likes to its own people or to its neighbors, and it's none of our business.
Okay. Peter Oborn, Janet takes the message from the Ukraine as an example of what happens when the West withdraws. Is that the message you take?
Well, what a good report that was from David Blair. But I think we need to moderate our language about Ukraine. Which is, you were just calling it a regime. Now, you like Syria or North Korea. It's a democratically elected president in free and fair elections. Now, regime has a certain connotation that this is an illegitimate gang. This is a democratically elected government. There are going to be elections next year. We supported this government until such time as it allied itself with Putin rather than us. We were very supportive of it. And now we have John Kerry saying that, who Janet Daly claims isn't an interventionist, saying we must stand with the people of Ukraine. Well, I mean, which people? They voted in their government, and they are now obviously having an internal convulsion, very much inspired by us, that extraordinary tape involving senior State Department people, which looked like they were micromanaging. I mean, the Americans were micromanaging the opposition. If this tape, the Pyatt Newland tape, was true, I don't know a great deal about it. But I just want to be very careful about this very ignorant discourse that we have a pro-Russian regime which is oppressing the people of the Ukraine. This is an internal argument involving Ukraine where we have clearly taken one side.
But Janet, we'll let you in, yeah. But a government can be democratically elected. It can even have majority support. It can still be a regime.
Yeah, Hitler was democratically elected.
In the sense of it doing terrible things to the minority.
This is another example, Janet Daly, of your very, very inflammatory, and if I may say so, ignorant arguments. There's plenty of... I understand that in the anti-regime, to use your phrase, not mine, elements, plenty of anti-Semites, plenty of people who think that Hitler's rather a good thing to be found in the opposition.
Yeah, I wasn't making the case.
Well, be careful about your language.
Hang on, about the Ukraine. I am talking. Let me get back to your John Kerry point. John Kerry is not a non-interventionist. John Kerry, before the Syria thing fell apart in that ridiculous pantomime that went on in Washington, when Obama, at the very last minute, threw the whole thing into the court of Congress in order to escape the moral responsibility for any intervention, John Kerry had given the most brilliant, thunderous speech of moral justification for intervening in Syria. That's why we all in the news media assumed that the bombing was about to begin. And it was only literally at 5 minutes to midnight that Obama hung him out to dry and threw the whole controversy into Congress. From that moment on, from the moment that Syria crossed the red line that Obama had set down and nothing happened, that was the moment when everyone decided, the world decided, that America was no longer a force. And Europe, we have known for some time, is no force in terms of any kind of moral enforcement against genocide or enslavement of your own people. And here we are. This is where we find
but
ourselves.
But I think Peter would say that you have to choose your battles correctly,
carefully,
but correctly.
Absolutely.
And that in the case of Ukraine,
of course,
this might be a very complex situation.
Of course. But Putin, enfranchisement, as it were, of the Russians, of Putin as world peacemaker, this has come about specifically because America has abandoned the field. Putin is now king of the world. He had the most spectacular propaganda victory over Syria. Ridiculously. I mean, this ex-KGB thug. You know, is that what you want, Peter? You want a post-American world where China can intimidate Japan and Russia can intimidate Georgia and Ukraine with impunity? Is that what you want?
Peter?
I think one of the problems with the United States, a country from which I believe you come.
Yes, and left. So don't tell me I don't know about America's problems.
Is that it has a very... its diplomats and its people have a very, very binary view of the world, divided between good guys and bad guys. And the Americans have constructed a world in Ukraine where the good guys are the opposition because they're on our side, and the bad guys is the democratically elected president. And our language is very inflammatory. We are clearly stimulating the protesters. I don't deny their bravery, and I. Judging from David Blair's report, it looks extraordinarily likely that snipers have been used against them, and I completely condemn that. But I think that messing around in the Ukraine is a incredibly dangerous
thing to do. Of course it is.
And in Syria, too. Now, and I, once again, in Syria, just to deal with some of your comments there, I mean, the notion that there were the good guys who were the opposition... And the Assad lot were the bad guys. I mean, I would just beg you to consider what Saudi was doing, or has been doing in Syria, the Al-Qaeda mob that has been backed, and we've been backing. America finds it very, very difficult to understand how the world works.
Look, Peter,
we saw a series of diplomatic cables in statements in Congress recently, which show the most staggering ignorance, even
senior people in the State Department. I totally understand that. Peter, you can't tell me anything about America. I chose to leave there. I am now a British citizen. I know everything that's wrong with the kind of parochialism and the ignorance of American foreign policy, but that is neither here nor there in this case. Syria, the reason Al-Qaeda was able to move in and take over the opposition in Syria is because the West did nothing. We gave them the most wonderful coup by saying, nobody is going to look after you. You might as well turn to Al-Qaeda because we're not going to help you. Al-Qaeda looked like their only friend in the region. So we handed that to Al-Qaeda by not helping the dissidents, by not giving arms to the dissidents, supporting the dissidents when we might have. The question of whether America is brilliant or ignorant is neither here nor there. Somebody in the West has to take responsibility. Otherwise, we're licensing mass murder anywhere that any regime chooses to inflict it.
It looks to me much more likely we are helping, unfortunately, to precipitate it by very reckless conduct. I don't know enough to be certain about this in Ukraine. I'd like to study it more. But it's not clear to me that we aren't giving encouragement to the opposition in Ukraine in the same way, for instance, that we did through reckless language in 1991 when we effectively condemned the Shia death in southern Iraq.
Now, nobody was condemning the Ukrainian presidency until he started killing
people. The other point about democracy, we say we're on the side of democracy. This is something which we claim. I'm very sceptical about it. I'm more sceptical about it after the Ukrainian experience. We have
a democratic
the claims that the West is on the side of democracy. We backed, effectively, or we failed to condemn the military coup against a democratically elected government in Egypt because we didn't like the nature of the government which won the elections. And now, having supported government elected democratically in free and fair elections in Ukraine, we're now condemning it.
Because it's changed sides.
Because
it's committing genocide.
You
it's
must get your language right.
This is very loose. It's assassinating.
No, this is very stressful. I'm not going to... You've really got to learn to use proper language.
Genocide is
such an insult to what the people...
It's assassinating its own citizens.
Accepting that it was the wrong word, Janet.
Yeah, and
please.
We abandoned the Egyptian government, which we had supported after the Arab Spring, because it wanted to adopt Sharia law. And because it went in for Muslim extremism and fundamentalism. That is anti-democratic. So it's not a question of whether we support
democracy. Democracy are okay so long as they're pro-British and American. This is a hopeless situation.
I must let Janet speak. Because I think in Janet's defence, not that she needs defending, she can defend herself, but I think the argument really isn't so much about whether or not America gets things wrong. Yeah. It's about whether or not America should do anything at all.
Or whether anybody should do anything
at
all.
Right.
This is about the decline of the West as any kind of moral agent in the world, which it seemed to think became acceptable after the end of the Cold War on some cosmic level. And admittedly, there have been interventions since then when outrageous things have happened within countries. But that's not the point is that America now, quite specifically and explicitly, is not even apologizing for this, is making it clear that it is intending to withdraw from that kind of world interventionist role. It's declining the notion of American exceptionalism because Obama has said, again, quite explicitly, that he wants to create a kind of European social democracy in America. We're not going to spend a fortune on defense anymore. We're going to spend it at home on the kind of welfare programs that Western Europeans have become accustomed to.
Right.
That is his policy.
Okay, and Peter, do you think there is a role for the West when it comes to guiding, advising other countries as to how to develop into democratic nations?
Oh, absolutely, and I do think that we do that quite well. I mean, you know, that it's our military, all sorts of advice about establishing the rule of law, about building parliaments, about building civil society. I'm a great supporter of certain types of foreign aid as well. I think we can play an incredibly creative role. We can educate people. We can spread. We can help to articulate what it means to be democratic, to be tolerant. We're talking here, I think, about military intervention. Yeah. And even there, I think there is a can be times we can point to cases where it has worked. But I don't think that it's tended not to. Its recent record has been unfortunate. I don't think that it's worked in Afghanistan. It certainly led to terrible consequences in Iraq. I think if Janet, I think, is suggesting, Janet Daly, that somehow we should intervene in a military sense in Ukraine.
No, I'm not.
Well, you seem to be complaining about our lack of action.
So. I'm saying that because of the vacuum that was created by Obama's and the West's general pull out of world affairs, Russia felt free, Putin felt free, and China feels free to intimidate Japan. All kinds of truly imperialistic regimes feel free to intimidate their neighbours and to act with impunity because the West has resigned.
Let's be quite clear about one thing. America is a truly imperialist regime. And if you just look at its record since World War II, you can just see that. The way in which American government has supported one foul dictatorship after another throughout Latin America and the Middle East. It's propping up, as we speak, Saudi. It's propping, you know...
But some of that has been to the benefit of the people involved. I mean, for example, South Korea, I'm sure, is very grateful for the West's united effort to keep it free. Those people, thankfully, don't have to live the way that their northern cousins do.
Yeah, but I could point equally to the way in which repeatedly the United States has undermined and destroyed democratic movements. I point you towards Algeria, where a government gets elected, which they didn't like. The Americans sponsor a coup, and we have 10 years of absolutely murderous and terrible civil war. Yeah. I point you towards the CIA plot to dismantle the Mossadegh democratic government in Iran, which has still poisoned events to this day. And somehow to see America as some sort of benign presence on the world stage.
I don't. I see it as the one remaining superpower, and therefore it has moral responsibilities. It gets it wrong all the time. There's no question about that. But the fact that no one is prepared to play that role now, certainly not Europe in its enfeebled, useless state, means that be careful what you wish for, Peter. If you're wishing for a post-Western world, a post-European world, a post-American world, you may really reap the whirlwind.
Peter, I'll give you the final word.
Well, I share a form of analysis of Janet Daly, which is I do think we are moving towards a sort of balance of powers from a world where America briefly felt that it was the one hegemon.
Peter Oborne and Janet Daly, thank you both very much. We'll be back to talk about God and conservatism after this brief word. This episode of The Telegram is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, as well as a 100-strong Dublin, New York, and Oregon-based customer support team, on hand 24/7. And as a Telegram podcast listener, you'll receive 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code Telegraph. Archbishop Vincent Nichols, the Cardinal Delegate, has found himself locked in a public debate with David Cameron about benefits. The cleric says that the government is tearing up the safety net with its reforms. The Prime Minister says that he's just trying to help poor people off welfare and into work. It raises the bigger question, is Christianity even compatible with philosophical conservatism? After all, Jesus kicked the money changers out of the temple, and David Cameron gave them a tax cut. Peter Stanford, who edited the Catholic Herald, I want to ask you, do you think that one can be legitimately a right-winger and a devout Christian?
I think in theory you probably could be. And indeed, if you look at the ranks of MPs in Parliament, you have Conservative Christians and you have Labour Christians, and you even have Liberal Democrat Christians. So yes, I think in theory one can be. I've failed always to manage it myself, I have to say. And I think if you look at the
recent... Have you tried? Have you seriously tried to sort of reconcile?
My mother was very keen on Margaret Thatcher and used to try and accompany me into the voting booth when I was 17, I think. But no, I mean yes, to an extent that I think if you look at, say, the guidance from the Catholic bishops that they issue most times around elections, they talk about the common good, and they're very, very careful not to say vote Labour at the end of it. And so, in theory, that guidance around what is the common good could be equally applied to any of the parties. I mean, I think there's a distinction here as well between sort of social conservatism in terms of kind of, you know, family morality, where Christianity clearly fits in much more with ideas of family and some of those Christian beliefs. And then Christianity's kind of message about, as Pope Francis would put it, a poor church for the poor. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever described the Conservative Party as a poor party for the poor, really. So in that sense, it's rather difficult to reconcile the two.
And also, a large number of mainline Christian churches have moved to the left on social policy. I mean, the Catholic Church has stuck rigidly to orthodoxy, but the Anglican Church has become considerably more liberal. Does that mean that with the mix of economic social democracy and social liberalism, it's just a natural fit to be left-wing and at least Anglican?
I mean, I think Anglicans would rather dispute that, and perhaps Peter can talk to that more. I mean, I think they would say perhaps they're not quite as kind of rigid in upholding traditional kind of family values around sexual morality as the Catholic Church is. But I think to somehow put them in the kind of progressive, kind of secularist corner on all that might be slightly overstating it. And again, if you go back to the kind of political debate and the political divides, I mean, certainly if you look at Robert Runcie's Faith in the City report in the 80s, where, you know, he was hailed as the leader of the opposition against Margaret Thatcher. You know, the major statements by both Catholic and Anglican churches in this country in recent years have been directed against Conservative governments. Very, very little complaint, really, against Labour governments, except around those kind of family, those social religious issues.
OK, Peter Obourne, do you see a tension between Conservatism and Christianity, particularly this government's agenda when it comes to welfare, tax and the economy?
Funnily enough, I really don't. I think there's much more of a tension, always has been, between socialism, which is a radical secular analysis of society and great directly denies God. And Marx sort of ridiculed the idea of, you know, the church is sort of a form of sort of false consciousness. Whereas the Conservatives very much articulate, I think, the vision of Christ. And not all of them. And by the way, I don't want to maintain that Christianity or any other religion belongs to any political party, much bigger and more important than that. But I definitely think that Christianity is compatible with conservatism. The Christ teaching about free will, if you look at it, is so important. We have our own moral obligation to God to make the most of our talents. And it's not decided for us. The socialists say, look, Gordon Brown did this. He's created a welfare state which determined how you conducted yourself, whether you could work, how you should live, constructed constraints against getting married and so forth. This was very much a statist argument, and which the churches should have repudiated, and I was amazed they didn't. And whereas the Christian teaching about free will is so compatible with what the Conservatives are doing about welfare reform at the moment.
Peter Stanford, indeed the welfare system as we have it is indeed about compelling people. It's not about the voluntary spirit. It's not about people doing things because they want to or because they're trying to earn points when it comes to getting into heaven. It's forcibly taking tax from people and then giving it to people, which can then leave them stuck on benefits for a long period. There's nothing particularly Christian about that, so why do churches defend it?
I mean, I think you have to look. I mean, in this particular debate that we're having at the moment was prompted by Vincent Nichols' remarks around kind of welfare reform. And actually, he was very careful there to say that he didn't oppose the idea of welfare reform per se. And, you know, there is Ian Duncan Smith, a very devout Catholic, introducing these changes. He was worried around the kind of implementation of it. And I think it presents a bit of a dilemma for Christianity. There's a very famous remark by a Brazilian bishop called Helder Câmara back in the the 70s and 80s who said, when I give the poor food, they call me a saint. When I ask why they haven't got food, they call me a communist. And I think the church walks an uneasy line between those two. So, but what Vincent Nichols was talking about was, here are food banks, here are parish priests hearing about the difficulties people are having because of the operation of these welfare reforms, and the church is absolutely with them, the poor church for the poor. But I think it is very difficult for the church simply to do that and say, you know, it really isn't for us to ask kind of bigger questions about why these people are poor, why they haven't got food.
Yeah.
It then naturally leads into that sort of analysis.
It's part of the problem when churches do try to provide solutions.
Indeed. And, you know, there is this argument always that the churches should keep out of politics. I mean, one of the people who always said the church should keep out of politics was Pope John Paul II, which was always rather amusing because he told his priests they weren't allowed to get involved in politics and then spent virtually three quarters of his pontificate getting involved in politics himself, notably in Eastern Europe. So I think that line about politics and church, I think the church is inevitably a kind of political organisation, and indeed its entire history is around politics. So it is going to get involved. And I would say that in recent times, the majority of its interventions have been more on the left side of the debate than on the conservative side of the debate.
Peter Raybon, is that because of a lack of religious conservatism in this country? I mean, if we were having this conversation in America, we'd be having an entirely different conversation. We'd be talking about evangelical and Catholic remarks about abortion, gay marriage, etc. Whereas it's interesting that in England, the perception is always that the church is coming from the left.
Yeah, it is curious. I completely agree with you. It's worth saying, I think a lot of people listening to this won't realise, that the people around Ian Duncan Smith tend to be either Catholic or evangelical Christians in the Anglican side of things. And they are driven by a very profoundly moral idea that Labour's welfare state was specifically designed to create a client state, basically make people dependent on the state for their livelihoods and keep them trapped in poverty. The vision of, or near poverty, the vision of the Conservative Party is that you retain that safety net, and there still is quite significant sums paid to people who are on the dole for no fault of their own or through fault of their own. But you're going to take away the disincentives to self-expression, to finding a job, massive prejudice against getting a job under Gordon Brown's welfare state. It was a 95% tax rate for somebody who went off the dole and into a job. And Archbishop Nichol comes from Liverpool. He's an old-style socialist politically. He is speaking not, in my view, as a Catholic, as a Christian. He is speaking as a Labour Party machine politician.
Okay.
And it's a great tragedy. He's betraying his church. And by the way, the church he entered was the Church of Franco. And the Catholic Church upheld fascism throughout the Third World. And really, Archbishop Nichol needs to reflect very deeply on his conscience and the causes supported by Catholicism throughout the Third World. Contraception, he's against poverty, but he's for contraception. Here's a message for you, Archbishop Nichol. There is a major connection between no birth control and mass poverty. So start to think profoundly about what you're saying. You talk the most ghastly load of total bilge. I've never heard such rubbish.
Peter Stanford.
Okay. First of all, Vincent Nichols has never, to my certain knowledge, given a sermon or spoken about contraception in that sense.
He has never challenged the Catholic doctrine.
Well, let Peter Stanford answer. Yeah.
As someone who comes from Liverpool, I think this characterisation of Liverpool as full of old-fashioned socialists, just because you come from Liverpool, you must be an old-fashioned socialist, is of course nonsense. I think the person to look at in terms of Vincent Nichol's own development was Derek Warlock, who was Archbishop of Liverpool when Vincent Nichol was a young priest. Now, what happened in Liverpool in the 80s was that they had a completely bonkers local council run by militant tendency who brought the city to the abyss, really, sending out taxis with redundancy notices. When that all collapsed in this terrible dispute with the Conservative government, it was Derek Warlock as Archbishop of Liverpool and Derek Shepherd, as Anglican Bishop of Liverpool, who together kind of united the city around kind of practical ways to kind of to rebuild relationships with government, rebuild infrastructure. So he's not an old-fashioned socialist in any way at all. He's a very practical, pragmatic man. And I think just to go back and to say it one more time, it's very important to look at what he actually said. What he said was he wasn't opposed to the idea of welfare reform, wasn't opposed to the idea that, you know, people should be better off if they had work, wasn't opposed to the idea of you know, removing this extraordinary bias towards taking money from the state as opposed to working. He was worried about the implementation, some of the people who were falling through the cracks in all of that. That's what he was talking about in practical terms, not in philosophical terms.
Peter Ebon, Russell Kirk said that any kind of ideology is a heresy because it puts something before God. It gives an explanation for something that somehow trumps God. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's actually that remark I profoundly agree with, and that's very interesting because conservatism is not an ideology. It's a sort of sceptical approach of mind, a certain disposition, as its greatest 20th century sort of articulator Oakeshott pointed out, and as Burke pointed out, it's the originator really of modern conservatism. Whereas socialism is an ideology. And it is amazing, therefore, to find a leading religious figure, the head of the Catholic Church in this country, supporting ideological politics rather than the conservatives.
I'm going to let Peter Stavridis have the final word on this. And in Cardinal Designate's defence, he did really focus his remarks upon people who lost their benefits because of bureaucratic failure.
Oh, we can all agree with that.
Yeah, we can all agree with that. Peter Stanford, what do you think is the right role for church leaders when it comes to public policy discussions like this? And how does one avoid controversy?
I think it's impossible to avoid controversy. I think the right role for them is, you know, one of the extraordinary things both the Church of England, the Catholic Church, other churches have is a grassroots network. They actually know what is going on at the grassroots, whether it be in Liverpool, in poor areas of the country, wherever. They know what is happening. It seems to me sometimes, listening to Ian Duncan Smith and people around him, they haven't got the foggiest idea what goes on in real people's lives. You know, we have this cabinet made up of Etonians. And I think actually the right role of the church is to build on that grassroots network, that ability to listen to people's problems and to present them to government and say, look, you know, this may be your ideology, this may be your chosen solution, it may work, but this is the pain that it's causing.
Peter Stanford and Peter Ebon, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.